The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Create, do, explore. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
A few years ago, Joe Lewin was working for one of the world's most respected newspapers, that is, the UK's Financial Times, reporting on market swings, budgets and fiscal policy. And he did all of this while hiding a secret from his colleagues. He's here to talk to us this morning. Joe Lewin, good morning to you. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning, Ryan. Nice to talk to you too.
Could you give us a little flavour about your background in terms of where you grew up and what you did at university?
Yeah, well, I grew up in a place called Aylesbury in Buckinghamshire. It's a small town, sort of fairly average. And then I went to university, studied languages there, French and Russian. And from that, I went into journalism.
Okay, and that brings you neatly enough to the age of 24, working at the Financial Times. Young age, big paper.
It's quite exciting. It's kind of almost overwhelmingly exciting to be, you know, reporting on some of the biggest stories of the day, especially with, you know, a lot of the excitement going on in the markets around that time.
And you were working in the newsroom environment, which we know about here, the idea of breaking news. It's a rush. There's a great buzz off that. Did you enjoy that element of it?
Yeah, it was absolutely thrilling. Keeping an eye on the markets, seeing what the biggest stories of the day were, watching the swings, bashing out stories. Yeah, I just loved all of that. And being kind of in the middle of the newsroom was a rush, really.
Right, but it wasn't a satisfying enough rush, if you like, because you needed something else to help you along the way, in a manner of speaking. Tell us about the kind of arc of your narcotics intake. Where did it begin, and what were you dealing with at the start?
So I started drinking when I was about 11, 12.
Right,
from my first drink, I just loved the way it made me feel. You know, all kind of anxiety and discomfort slipped away. I felt comfortable with who I was when I started drinking. Mm-hmm. And then a few years later, sort of 13, I started smoking cannabis. And again, I just loved what it did to me. I was kind of fascinated by the fact that something could change the way I felt about myself, make me feel more comfortable in my own skin. And, you know, from that point on, I was just keen to kind of experiment with various substances. And it was, you know, at first it was fun. I just had fun, really, with drugs. But then kind of in my early 20s, alcohol started to become more than fun. It started to kind of become a crutch to help me deal with other issues, such as, you know, anxiety, things like that. And from that point on, it kind of became a case of self-medicating.
Sure. And when you were in Cambridge University, obviously university for a lot of students, drugs is part and parcel of the university experience. Was yours a bit more intense than the average student, or was it same as everyone else?
I'd say it was perhaps a bit more intense. I mean, it was kind of halfway through my degree that kind of drug use went from being something that was fun to being something that was more of a kind of support to deal with other issues. You know, alcohol was the first thing I came to depend on. And then from that point on, it was kind of Valium and Speed, and then escalated to opiates.
And the idea of self-medicating, what were you medicating for?
Mainly anxiety, a whole kind of raft of negative feelings about myself, kind of low mood, just a general sense of angst and discomfort with who I was, with life. And I found it really mysterious and baffling, because if I looked at my life on the outside, it seemed like everything was okay, but inside I just felt just something wasn't right, and drugs seemed to fix that.
And was it a sort of self-perpetuating scenario then, that you felt add one drug to another to cure another, to cure another, to cure another, and then it just, you were into a cycle?
Yeah, it is kind of like that. And eventually the consequences of the drug use start to compound the things I was trying to escape from in the first place. So the consequences of my drug use made me more anxious, made me feel kind of more ashamed. And then I would use more to try and escape from those things, and it becomes a vicious cycle.
Yeah. And yet, as you describe, you're a fully functioning member of society. You're going to work. I presume you're a bit of fun, and you had good colleagues and a good attitude to the job, including getting front page headline stories on the Financial Times. But could you give us and our listeners a little bit, Joel, of when you were getting into serious drugs in the workplace, of a typical working day, which brings us to, you know, a 5:45 a.m. start on the radio?
Yeah. So I would wake up at 5:45 a.m. I'd set my alarm with Radio 4, which would normally be Farming Today at that time. And then I'd have a hit of heroin to kind of get me going to start the day. Then I'd try and eat a bit of food, listen to what the markets had been doing overnight, check up on any moves. And then by 7 a.m. I'd be at my desk at the FT, kind of ready to report on the release of trading statements, kind of company quarterly and annual statements. And then 8 a.m. the markets would open. I'd be, you know, bashing out stories on the biggest movers of the day, what currencies were doing, things like that.
And then you'd need to steady yourself, I take it, after all that excitement.
Yeah. Well, by that point, it would have been a good few hours since my first hit of the day, so I'd need to kind of top up in the... I'd go to the toilets in the basement to basically keep myself well, because by that point, you know, I was completely physically dependent on heroin. So, you know, a few hours without it and I'd be feeling sick, so I had to keep kind of constantly topping up throughout the day.
And then lunchtime, of course, you're feeling another way entirely, so off to the chemist with you for what?
So I had a methadone prescription, so I'd go to the chemist every day and take that, and that would kind of, well, ideally hold me for the rest of the day till sort of later in the afternoon, later in the evening.
And I haven't asked you the question about the heroin, because I was so engrossed by your typical working day, and we're only at lunchtime. But how did heroin come into the equation? If when you go from cannabis or booze or amphetamines or whatever, heroin's really the big league.
I guess it is. It was kind of just part of the progression, really. You know, one day a friend offered me some to try, and I tried it and I loved it. And then it kind of escalated from there. At first, it made me feel like everything was easier, because compared with alcohol, which would give me horrible hangovers and stuff, heroin felt kind of steady. And that might sound a bit strange to people who aren't familiar with it, but, you know, in the first few years, it was kind of a steadying influence almost on my life. But then, you know, that doesn't last forever. And then the problems I was trying to escape in the first place kind of came back many magnitudes greater.
Yeah.
And I was left with the added burden of a heroin addiction, which is not exactly an easy ride.
As a matter of curiosity, how did you mask the heroin addiction in the workplace? Because you described going to basement toilets, disabled toilets, places where you can hide. But there's only so much you can hide, because you must have had a certain pallor even about your face, or a certain twitch maybe in your behaviour, or were you just brilliant at covering it up?
There were times when I was questioned about things, you know, so I did start to look increasingly unhealthy. And the occupational health at work, they kind of suggested a few nutritional changes, things like that. Yeah, I mean, sometimes I would have to cover up with lies. And I mean, I'd like to think of myself now as an honest person, but as an addict, that, you know, dishonesty did kind of come quite naturally. So I would concoct, you know, stories about having to head off for a meeting for a few hours, things like that, to kind of cover things up.
And why were you banned from all the supermarkets near your flat?
Well, I was caught shoplifting, you know, on multiple occasions, because as I started to kind of look sicker, started to get, I suppose, recognised, and maybe became a bit more careless as my addiction escalated, I'd get caught, you know, increasingly regularly, and I was banned from quite a lot of supermarkets. Because, I mean, my addiction would basically consume all of my money, really. And, you know, so I didn't really want to spend a penny on food. I mean, sometimes I couldn't, sometimes I could, but chose not to.
You love Shakespeare, as I understand it, and your encyclopedic knowledge of toilets and your interest and love of William Shakespeare kind of combined as well at one point.
Just around the corner from my office was the Globe Theatre. And, you know, I've always loved Shakespeare. And I would, before my addiction really took off, I would go and see plays there. But, you know, as it escalated, I would just really use that building, because it had a kind of quiet, rarely used disabled toilet in the basement. So I would kind of pitch up there and, you know, spend time there if I, you know, was in a rush, needed to have a hit somewhere. That was often a kind of ideal location. But it kind of underscored to me just how much drug use was ruining my life. I was sitting in that building, just in the basement, in the toilet, rather than actually going there for what it was supposed to be used for watching wonderful plays.
At what point, Joel, did somebody somewhere, be it family, friend, work, turn around and say, do you know what, you look like you're in some state, we need to confront it? Who was that person, or was it over time, or was it a moment?
Initially, it was a friend who I was living with. I was sharing a flat with him, and he initially was, you know, gently encouraging me to try and change my ways, then increasingly desperately. And then eventually my parents became aware of my problems, and, you know, it scared them, really scared them. And they did, well, everything that they could, really. But it's quite baffling for a family to try and deal with somebody who's in the midst of addiction, because the behaviour can be so irrational and self-defeating. So, I mean, they had a really rough time.
You often hear stories of families trying to do the best for their son or daughter by ignoring them. Isn't that what they say? Just don't encourage them, don't invite them home. And that must be horrible for addict, but particularly the family, to have to try and deal with. So did you, now that you're sober, looking back, did you put your family through the mill?
Absolutely. You know, looking back, I've been absolutely ashamed and horrified by the way I treated them. But one of the wonderful things about recovery is I've had the chance to make amends to them, to, you know, to change my behaviour, to talk to them about the things that I've done, and to say to them, look, if there's any way I can make amends for what I've put you through, then please tell me. And that's a really wonderful feeling to be able to do that.
And how did you get fixed, if I could ask this question quite simply?
I thought that it would be as easy as just making a decision to stop. But I made that decision so many times. You know, I tried multiple different things. I tried going back to my parents' house and shutting myself up with no drugs for weeks. And as soon as I went back to London, I would start using again. I tried, exercise regime. I tried eating healthily. I tried various sort of support services in the area. It really baffled me how hard it was to stop. It was eventually when my life was really starting to fall apart, I was quite hopeless, really. I didn't think that I was going to be able to stop anymore, but I thought I'll just try one last time, and went to a rehab and kind of just threw myself into it, just did whatever was suggested of me. Anything they suggested, I would do it, because I never, ever wanted to go back to taking drugs again. And, I mean, finally, this time, it seems to have worked.
And where are you now? Where are you living, and what are you doing with yourself?
At the moment, I'm working in Thailand, helping other addicts get clean and stay clean.
And do you find that very heartening or rewarding and helpful to you?
I love it. Addicts are fascinating people. Everybody's got a story to tell. And I love working with other addicts. Helps me to put all the kind of bad experiences I've been through to a good use. And also, you know, during my addiction, I was really self-centered, and I hurt a lot of people. So it's really nice to be able to do the opposite and actually help people, support them.
And on those hopefully rare occasions when you crave a buzz, where do you turn to?
Well, there's quite a few different things that I turn to now. I mean, one of them is running. I just absolutely love running out in nature. I get a massive buzz from it. I like meditating. I like juggling. You know, anything that's kind of stimulating that helps me to focus on something else, you know, and to remind me that life is good and there's plenty of things to enjoy in the world.
Sounds good. Well, look, Joel, thanks for your time this morning. Wish you very, very, every good luck in your recovery, and I hope life is kind to you, and thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Ryan. Lovely to speak to you.
Thank you kindly. That's Joel Lewin joining us, former Financial Times journalist, but I think a story that will definitely resonate with a lot of listeners to this programme, whether it's addiction to anything from alcohol, smoking, gambling, but at that level of drugs into the heroin, and how our perceptions of what a typical heroin addict might be or might look like, and how wrong we might be. And a very honest person, and I enjoyed talking to him this morning. The text number 51551.